Hey, everybody. Welcome to the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday, and we've got a great interview lined up for you today. Now, I want to make a mention. You'll get the entire interview. The only segment of today's show you won't hear is our Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals. Why? Because that's under Stitcher Premium. We want to make sure that everybody gets a chance to hear these remarkable interviews of these incredible true crime stories. But for only $5 a month, you can subscribe to Stitcher Premium. That'll give you the entire episode. That includes the entire interview you're about to hear, plus Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals, and every episode of Darkness Radio, the best in paranormal podcasting, all 1,000-plus episodes commercial-free. And if that's still not enough reason for you to want to subscribe, you don't just get True Crime Tuesday and Darkness Radio, which, let's face it, for $5 a month, that's pretty valuable. You get every other show underneath the Stitcher umbrella. That means hundreds of thousands of hours of your favorite type of podcast programming commercial free. Nobody got time for commercials. So if you're interested, then make sure you go subscribe now to Stitcher Premium. Use code word Darkness Radio, all one word, Darkness Radio, for some deep discounts for an entire year's savings. Go do that right now. Take advantage of the special and be able to listen to Darkness Radio, True Crime Tuesday, and all of the other amazing programs across Stitcher's platform. Go subscribe right now. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of True Crime Tuesday. Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. A little later on in the program, for those of you that are premium Stitcher subscribers, you'll hear a brand new episode of Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals. For those of you that are just listening to our standard podcast, thank you for tuning in and spending some time. You'll get the entirety of the interview that we have today. And today's topic is chilling. The book is entitled Frozen Tears, The Fort Leonard Wood MP Murders. Our guest today is J.B. King. He's a retired 32-year member of the Missouri State Highway Patrol, who was assigned to Pulaski County, Missouri, his entire career. Pulaski County is also the home of the United States Army base of Fort Leonard Wood. And after his Highway Patrol retirement, he ran for office of Pulaski County Sheriff and served two terms from 2005 to 2012 before retiring once again. And now from 2013 to present, he has served as a reserve deputy with the Pulaski County Sheriff's Office as an assigned to the Detective Division. He is with us today to talk about this book. Thank you for being here with us and sharing this, Mr. King.
Well, I thank you for the call.
All right. This takes place back in January of 1977. And the book, again, we have a link for that book on today's program guide, folks, so you can find it very easily. Make sure when you get it, you rate and review the book as well. But what a horrific sense of tragedies unfold in this story. Let's start at the very beginning and talk to us about the victims of this crime. What can you tell us about them and their lives before January 13th, 1977.
Four innocent kids, ages 16 to 19, just starting out in the world. All but one was still in school at the time. And basically good, clean kids, no criminal past, no nothing. I've used the illustration before of they just four kids driving along and the lightning strike hit them.
They were just truly in the wrong place at the absolute wrong time.
Absolutely. No question about it.
Now, Fort Leonard Wood Military Reservation. Talk to me about this. What exactly is this location? You know, how many people do they have stationed there? What all is the history of that?
Well, Fort Leonard Wood was started as a result of the beginning of World War II. In 1939, the United States government annexed eminent domained, about 75,000 acres of real estate here in Pulaski County and constructed a military base on it. These days, the base population is probably about 36 to 37,000. They train combat soldiers in various arms. Plus, we now have the Marine Corps and the Army MP schools located here, along with the Army's chemical school. So this is a very busy place and kind of a high-tech place. We also have a cannon range operated by the United States Air Force, where F-16s, F-15s, A-10 Warthogs come in and do live strafing and bombing.
Is that area crime-ridden? I mean, is there a lot of issues going on there, or is it no worse than any other middle America kind of location?
Well, that's kind of a tricky question, because currently it's no worse than any other place on the map. However, in the early 70s, we had a prostitution, gambling, narcotics atmosphere here that wouldn't go away. We had organized criminal elements from the mob in Memphis, Tennessee, fighting for control of this area with the mob from St. Louis and Kansas City. And it got exciting around here. We had houses blown up, people shot. It was definitely a crime-ridden area in the 70s.
And the type of people that were the criminals, were they some of these rambunctious military personnel that were, you know, maybe teenagers or barely into the adulthood that were just lashing out and acting out on weekends? Or was it just a myriad of different types of problems?
A myriad of problems. For the most part, we didn't have that much of a problem with the GIs. The local civilian population that, I'll use the term, was preying on the GIs, trying to get their money with various schemes. Lots of problems there. At the time that this particular case occurred, we actually had a two-man FBI office stationed on Fort Wood because of the organized crime issues coming into this county.
So you literally had a full gambit of bad things happening all at once. So it was kind of the perfect storm area, it seems like, as well.
Oh, yes. We had shootings and stabbings almost every week.
Jeez.
And then when you throw in the federal element, because, you know, the FBI only investigates crimes on a federal reservation. Well, let me back up. I shouldn't put it that way. A murder case on a federal reservation is automatically their case. So this particular case became theirs instantly when the full details were known. But to get into the case, it got a little bit crazy and a little bit odd, I guess is the word I want to use.
Well, let's start on that fateful day. Talk to us about these kids, and what were their names?
Linda Needham, Tony Bates, Juanita Deckard, and Wesley Hawkins. They were on a double date, and they were driving across Fort Leonard Wood late at night. As near as we can tell from the research and the timelines, the actual time of the stop by the military police officer would have been around midnight, a few minutes either side.
What had their day consisted of?
They had been sitting at the house, talking, carrying on. I think they prepared a meal, just general all around. The fateful decision came when they realized that their vehicle that they were going to use the next day was almost out of gas, and they decided they better get some gasoline. But the local station was closed, and the only other place they could get it was to drive across Fort Leonard Wood into the city of St. Robert, which had several gas stations open. And that's basically what they were doing, simply taking a drive to go get gas.
So a leisurely drive to just go fill up their tank for their next day's adventures. And then this next horror story just unfolds in front of you. How, talk to me about this MP that they run into. Military police officer.
Well, if you don't mind, I'll back up just 1 second.
Please.
The situation with them was school. We had 8 inches of snow on the ground and more in the forecast, and so all area schools had already canceled. So they knew they had a free day the next day. So they weren't too concerned about what time they were going after the gas and things of that nature. Now, the MP that stopped them's name was Johnny Lee Thornton. And all of the research, everybody I have interviewed that actually worked with Thornton gave him extremely high marks as a conscientious, dedicated, hardworking military police officer. And every man that I interviewed that knew him personally had the same reaction. They were totally shocked that he did this. And then I think they wanted to bash his head in, but that's another right. story.
Well, what was his story? I mean, did he have a predilection for violence or flare-ups and anything prior to what happened here?
He had an arrest in California for burglary of a wig shop, and charges were eventually dropped on that. And that's basically it.
Was the military kind of his out from prison? I know that that was a big thing in the 60s and 70s. It was like, you know, if you were a screw up, a lot of times the courts gave you an opportunity of serving time or serving your country.
No, he out and out joined on his own. The charges had been dropped by the time he joined, so that wasn't an issue. He appeared to be a very hardworking, very conscientious member of the military police unit.
Was there any background or history of mental illness in him or his family that came out during all of this?
Not that I've been able to find. The only black mark, I guess you could call it, would be that his ongoing domestic situation with his wife was kind of a disaster most of the time. Constant fights, separations, that sort of thing.
But nothing that would lead to the lid blowing off like it did. All right, so that night, these four teenagers set out to get some gas for their next day's adventures. How do they end up crossing paths with the military police?
Driving across Fort Leonard Wood on it's a state highway on both sides of the post, and it's a Fort Leonard Wood military highway on the post itself. Basically, that night, Thornton was hunting for victims. He made four suspicious traffic stops in a row where he would simply walk up to the car, look in. The driver would be a male. And I think two cases, he didn't even bother to ask the guy for his driver's license. He just looked in, you know, we're looking for, and gave him a story that we're looking for somebody and you're not that person, so sorry to bother you. Have a good night. But when he got to the kids and stopped them, he told them that their vehicle matched the description of a car that had been involved in an armed robbery, and he named a closed gas station on the south side of the post, which was kind of ironic at the time because Wesley Hawkins, one of the victims in the car, his brother worked at that particular gas station. So when the MP told them that they were going to be taken into custody and transported to the MP desk for further questioning, you know, they knew they had not committed a robbery and that it'd be cleared up in a matter of minutes, so they allowed themselves to be handcuffed with no problem. And then things kind of went south.
This is horrific that this unfolds the way it does. Please go ahead. He handcuffs all four, puts them in his vehicle.
No, he just handcuffed two of them. He only had two sets of handcuffs.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of a clue in itself, because at the time the MPs were only required to carry one set of handcuffs. And on this particular night, when he checked out from the MP command with his equipment, he specifically asked for two sets of handcuffs. That became a point of contention at the trial later on. So he handcuffed the boys. He put them in the back seat of the vehicle. The vehicle was an International Scout four-wheel drive, which has a bench seat in the back. So we put the two boys in the back, and he put the youngest girl, who was 16, in between them. He had the older girl, who was 19, sit up front with him. And then just before he drove off, he pulled out his issue 45 pistol and shot both boys in the back seat.
So they're just, are they engaging him? Are they talking to him, taunting him, anything, questioning his authority? He went with the concept of murder and abuse. This was his evening plan, wasn't it?
Everything that I've been able to uncover says yes. He hunted for victims that night, deliberately ignored people that did not have a female in the car. But as soon as he came to the car with the two females, the hunt was on.
He fires two rounds. How many shots, I guess, he fires at the two men, but how many shots does he end up firing in total to take these guys out?
Actually, he fired three. He hit both boys one time each. And now we're talking, he's standing in the driver's side door shooting at two kids in the back bench seat, which cannot be more than 4 feet away from him. He totally missed with one round that came out the tailgate of the vehicle and went across the highway and lodged in a snowbank on the other side. So he fired three shots there. Wesley Hawkins was shot squarely through the heart and died instantly. Tony Bates took a round in his lower abdominal region and was still alive 6 hours later.
Oh, my God. So he was just slowly dying through this entire exchange.
Yes, and you have to remember that at the time we had 8 inches of snow on the ground. The temperature was in the low 20s to high teens, and we had a 18 to 25 mile an hour north wind blowing. And during the course of the evening, Tony Bates had to sit in the vehicle wounded for several hours without the vehicle running. So in addition to the gunshot wound, he was probably also freezing to death.
Do you think that's what slowed the progression of his death? The cold, maybe thickening the blood so he wasn't bleeding out as hard?
Yes and no. That played a factor in it, I'm sure. But the actual bullet wound, the most serious damage that it did, according to the autopsy, was it nicked his kidney. Other than that, it was a clean through and through. It did, of course, get the intestinal tract, but it wasn't an immediately fatal wound, and they established that clearly at autopsy.
When he fires at these two men, how do the girls react?
Total shock. From that point on, they did everything he said without question. I mean, it just total domination, total overwhelming of their emotions and senses. It had to be an extremely overwhelming situation for them to deal with.
Do they feel that, you know, they're just going to stay in the vehicle because they're afraid if they try to leave, he might open fire on them as well?
That I can't answer. The one girl is deceased and the other one made no mention of anything like that in any of the interviews. Stupefied, I think, would be maybe a word to use in this case. They just totally emotionally overwhelmed, didn't know what to do. And basically just sat there. In fact, at one point, Thornton got out of the vehicle while he was still at the scene where he shot the two boys, went over to their car and flattened a tire. And while he was gone, he left the military police vehicle running, but it was a stick shift. And the two girls did not know how to drive a stick shift. So in that 20, 30, 40 second window where they could have got behind the wheel and taken off, they did not do so.
Oh, God. A moment to haunt them. And again, you know, it's really easy, folks, to think as you sit in the luxury of your home or office or car listening to this podcast that, oh, I would have taken off. I would have fought. I would have to see something happen like this. And as you said, they were all aware they weren't involved in this crime. So they went along. They were good kids going along with the police, doing what was requested of them. And then to watch this unfold, it had to be panic and shock and pure terror for them.
Oh, yes.
And you think you would react one way, and in a situation like this, it's probably something completely different in the way that your body and mind will try to process the information that you're watching unfold in front of you.
I have to agree fully with the way you described it.
Now, does he keep these boys in the car, or does he throw them out of the vehicle? What does he do at that point?
Okay. At this point, now, let me back up just a second. Since he's a game warden, he knows the remote areas of Fort Leonard Wood like the back of his hand. Practically everybody I talked to described him that way. He knew the post like the back of his hand. He took all four of them down to a deserted cabin on the Ruby-Doo River, which had a wood stove inside and a couple of beds. And he built a fire in the stove. He brought the girls inside, left the boys outside in the vehicle. And during the course of the evening, he made several trips back out to the vehicle, and the girls could hear him talking to the boys, which in their terrorized state really confused them, because the survivor said that she thought maybe he had somehow immobilized them and they really weren't shot, kind of an anesthetic type situation. You know, they were just totally confused.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, again, you're in the situation. When he brings the girls in, though, the terror continues for them, right? It just doesn't end with them witnessing their boyfriends being shot and left outside to die in the cold in a vehicle. What happens once he brings them inside?
Well, that leads to a part of the book that I was extremely careful about writing. The surviving victim gave statements to the FBI and the Army's Criminal Investigation Division that would probably rival stories you might find in some type of blue magazine, detailed step-by-step of what happened. And I made the editorial decision right up front. I was not going to publish those details.
Right, obviously.
It's obviously a case of rape murder, and yes, he thoroughly raped and sexually molested both girls for approximately 4 hours. So you can understand that there's a whole lot of things that happened that really terrorized him again and were extremely brutal to him. But like I said, I've been a cop for 52 years now, and one thing I'm thoroughly in favor of is the victim. You know, I protect the victim. I feel for the victim.
Right.
And I just decided right up front, yes, I could put these scandalous details into the book, and it would help sell it. But I decided I didn't need to sell that many books, so you will not read that in the book.
No, now, but obviously, you give enough with the concept that they were abused and raped for 4 hours. So I don't think people need to hear the gory details of how and what. But was he obviously, you know, was he tying these girls up? How do you contain one while you're attacking the other? Or was it just in beating them severely?
Well, no, he didn't. He didn't strike them or hit them. You know, in their terrorized state, their totally confused state, the one thing that stood out was even after everybody's clothing had been removed, he continued to hold the .45 caliber pistol in his hand the entire time as the threat, the weapon, the boogeyman, if you will. So they had no thought of attempting to escape.
It's so hard to even process what that's like in that moment. And again, that you're just in a position where you're so terrified for you and your friends' lives that given these moments, you don't even attempt to make a break for it.
Right. And then remember a certain amount of confusion because they hear him going outside and talking to the two boys.
Right.
So they're also wondering, oh, did I really see him shoot my friends? Or, you know, what happened? What's going on? So total now, confusion on their part, plus terror.
JB, I know people are listening. They're like, well, if they weren't beaten, they weren't physically harmed, you know, aside from the sexual aspect of it, when he would go out to check on the boys, was there nothing in this cabin that the girls could arm themselves with that they could try to fight their way out?
Realistically speaking, no. It was a bare cabin with a double bunk bed, and there were no mattresses on the bunk bed. So, no, there was nothing. If they could have picked up the 200 or 300 pound pot-bellied stove and hit him over the head with it, you know.
Right, right. But there was logistically nothing. Oh, God. All right. After this attack, does he Is he promising the girls they're going to survive? Is he plying them that way?
He's talking to them the entire time. I don't want to say words of reassurance because that sounds totally off mark here. But when he was done with him, he had him get dressed again, took him out to the vehicle and made him get in. He then drove about a mile and a half from the cabin, stopped at this little logging road and told him to start walking down the logging road. And as they started down the road, he yelled at him to stop and turn around. And when they turned around, he opened fire on them.
It's hard to progress going forward with this kind of story. He opens fire. How many shots does he exchange this time?
We're not sure. We think four, but the ammo count that he turned in to headquarters and what we think he fired is off by one. But at the time this case occurred, it wasn't very hard to get a 45 caliber ACP cartridge in Pulaski County. They were everywhere. The story actually gets worse at this point because he's allegedly an expert marksman. He's probably firing at about 20, 25 feet. He strikes the older girl, Juanita, as she's turning. She has a bullet crease across her arm, and then the second wound is on her chest, just at the top of her breast. But it occurs as she's turning, and while it appears to be a through-and-through wound to the chest, seriously, you know, a serious wound, I think you could literally take an ink pen and stab somebody and do more damage. The other girl was not hit at all. She fell down either total terror or was smart enough to play dead. We don't know which, because after they were both on the ground, he drug them into the woods. He took the younger girl first, and as he was dragging her, evidently he realized that she had not been hit, and the snow from the scene was extremely helpful in outlining the crime as it occurred. It was quite plain that he stood directly over her and fired straight down into her heart, her instantly. And then he went back and drugged the other girl out, kicked her several times when he put her in the snow, and she was smart enough and tough enough to play dead and make it look good because, like I said, she had what appeared to be a through-and-through 45 caliber wound on her chest. You know, lots of blood running all over the snow. So she got away with it. And then he drug Wesley Hawkins out. Wesley was dead, put him in a snowbank. And he got Tony Bates out. And Tony was walking. We know that from the tracks in the snow that he walked. And he got to a point inside the woods. And by this time, Tony had to know what was going to happen next. Mm-hmm. He broke into a run trying to escape. Made it roughly 30, 35 feet before he tripped over a log that was hidden in the snow. And before he could get back up, Thornton came up behind him and shot him in the back of the head. And that wound was instantly fatal.
Right. So he's now four murders. It has to have a car full of blood. How is he even processing? He's going to bring this back, drop this car off and not have to answer for what took place.
I'm speculating here. As a game warden, they frequently picked up roadkill deer, things of this nature, and hauled them around to take them out to other areas and dump them away from the main cantonment area on Fort Leonard Woods. So blood in the back seat or floorboard of a MP vehicle assigned to the game warden detail was not exactly unusual. Now, when he turned the vehicle in the next morning, the MP that took it over and was going to drive it for the next shift, he asked that guy to run it through the car wash and clean it up because he got it real dirty the night before. His cover story for that was that he had shot three stray dogs, loaded them up, and then taken them to a specific dump on Fort Leonard Wood and dumped the dog carcasses. And, of course, that accounts for the blood.
Gotcha. The and book is called... go ahead.
And that also accounts for the expended rounds of ammunition, because They gave them 15. You had to turn 15 live rounds back in, or live rounds plus casings, whichever the count, as long as it came to 15. So the dogs were a convenient story both ways.
And probably something that they dealt with on a normal basis, so it wouldn't seem out of the ordinary.
Oh, totally normal.
The book is called Frozen Tears, The Fort Leonard Wood MP Murders. There's a link for it on today's program guide. Make sure you do pick up the book and read it as well. We'll be back with more. You're listening to the best in True Crime Talk Radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. Welcome back to the program. This is True Crime Tuesday. On January 13th, 1977, an on-duty military police officer kidnapped four teenagers on a double date, driving across the Fort Leonard Wood Military Reservation. What unfolded was terrifying, traumatic for all. And MP officer Johnny Lee Thornton was the center of this nightmarish crime, having raped and shot the two girls, leaving them for dead, killing the two boys. He simply goes about business as usual. Did friends of his, JB, co-workers, anything notice anything unusual about him after such a transaction?
Not a thing. He was perfectly normal at the equipment turn in at 6 a.m. the next morning. Not one thing. And I think that's one of the reasons all of his fellow MPs were so mad, because he totally tricked them, totally fooled them.
Well, how does this story unfold and bring him into it? You know, obviously the car has now been washed and cleaned, which is going to have an impact and effect on evidence. Where do we go in the story from here?
Okay. I need to correct one thing there. The second guy that he turned the vehicle over to and asked him to clean it, He did not realize that the equipment at the time was frozen and they couldn't do it, so the vehicle was untouched.
Oh.
That evidence was preserved.
Thank God.
Yeah. The way the case came about, relatives of the kids saw their car parked on the side of the road and started calling around to the MPs and the various law enforcement agencies, and eventually they were reported as missing, and the Army's military police investigators began working on a missing persons case with them. And then later that afternoon at 1:18 p.m., to be precise, the victim, who had managed to walk roughly 6 to 7 miles through 8 inches of snow with two bullet wounds, arrived at a house all outside of the Fort Leonard Wood boundary lines. She was suffering from hypothermia. I'm sure she wasn't making a whole lot of sense. But the lady at the house helped her change clothing, and in doing that saw the two bullet wounds. And eventually a call was made to the troop headquarters of the Missouri State Highway Patrol in Rolla. And at that point, I entered the case because Troop I sent me south to check on the so-called runaways. But they also said that one of the runaways had been shot. They weren't quite sure what was going on. And so I eventually arrived at a location which was inside Laclede County and found the victim and two of her friends that she had called to come get her sitting roadside, and commenced an interview with her.
And you were there firsthand with this. You know, you get the call, you're going in. What is your mindset going to this interview and to this moment?
Well, I'm not sure what I could say about the mindset. The one thing that you have to keep in mind when you're a working police officer is what is called in is not necessarily what you're going to find when you get to the scene. Mm-hmm. Now, I had been a trooper for 6 years at this point and had plenty of cases where I'm told that the devil is raising all kinds of havoc, and you get to the scene and it's one little old lady having a temper tantrum. So you learn that you can't take the phone calls and the complaints coming in as gospel. So I really wasn't sure what to think. But when I get down here and I pull up behind this car, the father of the deceased young lady in the woods jumps out of the vehicle and runs back to me, and he's basically screaming and hysterical, and he yells at me for probably a minute and a half, and I don't understand a single word he says. And he gets frustrated with me, and he finally stops and looks at me in disbelief, and then he points to the car and says, "Well, do something. She's been shot in the chest." So I run up to the car, and there's a young lady sitting here, clean clothing, hair's brushed out. There's no dirt, no blood, no evidence of any trauma anywhere, but she's sitting there quietly crying. And I looked at her, and she looked at me, and I said, "He said you were shot." And she held up her arm, and there was what appeared to be a bullet crease. Now, it could have been some other mechanism of injury, but it did appear to be a bullet crease. But I said, "He said you were shot in the chest." And she lowered her blouse, and when she did, here's a genuine bullet entry hole into her chest, not covered. It's glazed and crusted over. It's clearly not a serious wound. I'd seen enough gunshot wounds by then. I was something of an expert. And it clearly was not serious, but it definitely was a bullet wound. So I don't know what's going on, but this young lady's sitting here with two bullet holes in her. So definitely something. And so we start out, and I start asking questions, and she begins answering. And before long, I had the basic outline of the night. I then went to my vehicle and called in by radio to give the details to the troop headquarters so they could relay it to the MPs, because the crime was clearly on Fort Leonard Wood. And as a state trooper, I had no jurisdiction to investigate a crime on Fort Leonard Wood. I could assist if the federal authorities asked me to, but to go investigate on my own, no. And we had a secondary problem at the time in that everybody and their brother in this area had a scanner on a highway patrol frequency, so every word I said to Troop I was going to be known to several thousand people immediately, and I had to watch what I was saying very carefully. I basically just told them, "Don't ask me any questions, send me the highest ranking MP you can find and several officers, and get them out here quick with four-wheel drives." And for once, Troop I didn't argue with me. I guess I think the strain in my voice was enough to let them know that there was something bad going on. And so they did exactly what I asked.
JB, was this the type of town where you knew who these kids were already?
No. They were from the area south of Fort Leonard Wood,
okay,
in Texas County, and I did not patrol Texas County. Let me rephrase it. I could go into Texas County if I had to. We frequently answered a call in Texas County when the officers assigned to that area were not available. But as far as routine patrol down there and getting to know people, no, we did not do that.
All right. I just didn't know if this is one of those really tight-knit communities or not. Does she lay out for you? Does she lay out for you pretty closely what exactly happened and how it all went down, or is she kind of in a fugue state of confusion and shock?
No, that was the really odd part. I've never interviewed a victim like this before. This is going to be a weird way of putting it, but it was like talking to a computer. I would ask her a question and she would give me a computer perfect answer, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And her information flow was almost overwhelming. And I have to stop here and digress for a second, because
please,
roughly 1 year before this event, we had a situation where a military man flew in from Fort Polk, Louisiana, into the Fort Wood airfield, went looking for an MP officer, overpowered that MP, left him handcuffed to a tree on a firing range, took his equipment and his vehicle, and then went to the payroll office and said he was here to, take the payroll officer to the company area for payroll distribution, and basically walked off with about $55,000 and left the payroll officer in the trunk of the stolen MP car. He flew back to Fort Polk. Well, as a local officer, I had heard enough details of that case that I was very familiar with it. And my first thought is, well, here we go again. But an impersonation. But as I continued talking to her and the overwhelming details she was giving me, it finally sank into my head that I was dealing with a real-life MP officer that went rogue. no question. And I had to call the MPs for backup.
Yeah, I was going to say, that has to be real touchy. Did she know this person's name? Did she know anything about this aspect of who she was dealing with at this point?
No. And the investigation, which was extremely thorough, never established any connection between Thornton and any of the four kids.
Okay. So when the MPs show up, is the perpetrator among them?
No. But here we go. We have another twist. Right.
Okay.
Captain Raymond Beck of the 208th MP Company was the duty officer for the day. And so he basically comes up and says, okay, what have you got? Because at that point, they had enough details to know that they had dead kids in the woods. So I start filling them in. And we'd been talking for a couple of minutes when this four-wheel drive scout pulls up, and it's driven by the head of the Fort Leonard Wood Game Warden Detail, Sergeant Dick Jensen. And Captain Beck stops me and says, wait a minute, I want Sergeant Jensen to hear this because he's going to take the CID team down to the scene. So we go over to his scout and we start talking again. And one of the details that the surviving girl had given me was what we call an X-ray number. It's a little number on the side of the vehicle for identification purposes, for the purchase of gas, oil, tires, that sort of thing. It's a tracking device. The Highway Patrol used a similar program on our cars, so, you know, it was, you know, second nature to know that number was there. Well, the number she gave me, she thought was 327. And so as I'm standing here talking, you know, going through this stuff again, I get down to the point where she had mentioned that number. And as I'm starting to say it, I happen to glance down at the X-ray number on this scout in front of me, and it's X-ray X37. And that's close enough that I knew instantly this is the suspect vehicle. And I hate to say this, but I froze. I think in the book I used the example of, you know, the pillar of salt from the gospel.
From the Bible, right.
Because I turned into a pillar of salt dressed in blue. I couldn't talk. I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything. I was just staring at the number totally. I think my brain was electrocuted. I don't know how to describe this feeling to you. But after a period of time, I don't know, with 10 seconds, a minute, it seemed like two centuries went by, Captain Beck realized what I was looking at. I had already given him that number a few minutes before. He took one look at it, and his brain wasn't frozen. He turned to Sergeant Jensen and said, who had this vehicle last? And Jensen named two MPs, one of whom was Thornton, and then he said the fateful words. He said, oh, my God, Thornton said he shot some dogs last night. So we go from total unknown, what the hell do we have, to red-hot suspect in about 8 seconds.
And it didn't even... There was no buffering for them. There was no, this can't be one of our own. They, like, the pieces fell directly in place, and they jumped on it.
Well, they weren't sure. They jumped on it. They started down to the scene. Well, okay, let me back up. I left out a part. After this exchange, Captain Beck said, I've got to get to a phone, and I came out of my trance. I said, I know a gentleman just up the road, so he hopped in my vehicle, and I took him up to my friend's house, and we got on the phone with Fort Wood, or he did. He told him to grab Thornton and this other MP that had been mentioned, read them their rights, put them in a room under guard, and don't ask them any questions. Well, it wasn't but about a minute later, he was told Thornton had been in the office, had heard the news of a survivor, had checked out a .45 and a couple of magazines of ammo, and it already walked out the door. So basically the manhunt was underway.
Whew. Well, what is the next step? So, you know, you always hear that, you know, the police and the MPs will kind of have their back of their officers and obviously want to look outside that, but this is a pretty compelling, you know, whodunit, and it's just like, it's giving itself up. The story is revealing itself too quickly.
Well, Sergeant Jensen took a detail of CID officers down to the scene. And as they were going, they were talking and they're going, you know, wait a minute. He said, and, you know, they were comparing notes on what they'd overheard me and Captain Beck talking about. And they realized that, hey, there's blood here on the seat. So the senior agent immediately told them, move away from that blood. Then when they get down to the scene, they start looking the vehicle over a little bit better, and here's a bullet hole exiting from the tailgate. So they quickly, you know, put two and two together and realized this was a serious situation, and it more than likely was going to be an MP involved. And then, of course, they've got three bodies laying there in the woods, which...
Were they able to find those pretty readily?
Yes.
All right. Are you then, do you have to step back because this becomes military police, or do they need an outside influence, an outside enforcement agency to be a part of this to keep them honest?
No, it's totally their investigation, but let me back up. I left out one part. After Captain Beck talked to his command headquarters, I called my command headquarters and told them what was actually going on. And at the conclusion of my briefing, my troop commander told me, do whatever the MPs want you to do, period. And slight consultation there, and they decided they wanted armed checkpoints at all exits from Fort Leonard Wood. They were going to put up their own checkpoints, but they wanted civilian checkpoints just on the boundary line with uninvolved officers from outside the military. And since I was the closest guy to the back gate of Fort Leonard Wood, they sent me to the back gate. And at this point, Pulaski County is in Troop I. Texas County, which basically is the back gate, is in Troop G. So they sent Troop G officers up to back me up. I briefed them on what we had, and we began stopping everybody coming off base, looking for a white male wearing military uniform, 5'8", 160 pounds with brown hair. You know, about as common as you can get.
Now, how quickly does it go before they're able to, you know, get this guy and pin him down? Is he starting to become aware that there's a pretty big investigation going on?
Oh, yes. He's fully aware of that. He went to another deserted area on Fort Leonard Wood and went to a house just outside of the Fort Wood boundary and asked to use the phone. This was about 6:30. The manhunt would have commenced right around, let's see, I arrived at the scene with Juanita at 1:18. No, correction, just before 3. Basically, 58 minutes after I started talking to her, they started looking for him. And then at 6:30, he called in on the phone wanting to talk to his supervisor, Sergeant Jensen. What I didn't know at the time and didn't find out until I started researching the book was that when I left the scene heading for the back gate, Sergeant Jensen had turned to Captain Beck and said, Thornton is my man. He will call me. So they took Jensen to a phone at the MP command headquarters where he could, you know, be available. And sure enough, Thornton called him. Thornton agreed to meet with him at a obscure location on Fort Wood, deep in the woods. And at this point, the provost marshal himself, Colonel Perry Elder, Sergeant Jensen in uniform, were in the front seat of the vehicle going to meet him. But hidden in the back seat was FBI agent Bill Castleberry, who was the special agent in charge of the Fort Wood office. And when they get out to the scene where he's supposed to be, the plan that they had worked out on the phone was he would come out of the woods into the headlights where they could see him, and they would talk. Well, he didn't come out of the woods. But he did sneak up behind him, and then he told him he was behind him. So we now have a situation where instead of him being illuminated by the headlights of the patrol vehicle they were in, they are silhouetted by those lights. He's back in the dark, and their backup with the 12-gauge shotgun is laying on the floorboard of the vehicle and can't get up because Thornton will see him immediately. And then that led into a 25, 30-minute talk, conversation, you name it, before he finally agreed to lower his weapon and surrender.
What was his explanation for this? I mean, is he denying it at first, or is he owning up to what he did?
Oh, no. He's very confused. I think I did something wrong, but I don't know. I've got these headaches. I don't understand what's happening. What can you guys tell me? You know, that kind of stuff.
Do you believe he is building a potential insanity plea, or do you believe that there's some legitimacy to his Is this a mental break?
No, insanity plea all the way. Okay, how am I going to put this? This was a crime that really triggered the U.S. Army and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. As I said, we had a two-man FBI office here on post. They arrest him at 6:30 p.m. that evening. By the time we gather at 8 o'clock the next morning to really go into the investigation, there's 13 additional FBI agents standing in the room ready to go. Every CID agent on post is there. A platoon of military police, two platoons of 5th engineers with metal detectors, digging tools, and everything else you can think of. The Army went absolutely, I don't want to use the word crazy, extremely overkill to start the investigation. And it was needed because when they finally got to figuring everything up, they had 8 crime scenes and about 15 people they needed to have talked to yesterday that had to be immediately interviewed. And so they were quite taxed. The first few days of this investigation really was a blur for everybody out there. The special agent in charge, Bill Castleberry, got with the Provost Marshal, Perry Elder, and they made one critical decision between them. They split the agents up. They put an FBI agent with a CID agent and formed 14 teams that could operate by themselves or as part of a combined team. And the entire purpose for that was to preserve jurisdiction and prosecution, not only for the federal government, which, as I said earlier, the FBI investigates murders on a federal installation, for federal court, which was headquartered in Kansas City at that time, with a sub-headquarters in Springfield, Missouri. But it also put the Army in a position to conduct a court-martial if necessary, and that turned out to be an extremely critical move in this case.
In what sense?
I'm sorry, what, sir?
I said, in what sense did that become such a critical point?
Well, as it turned out, the area where he shot the kids, the two girls and Tony Bates, may or may not have been on Fort Leonard Wood. It was right smack on the boundary line. And then when they got to investigating this case and preparing the legal stuff, they found out that the property had not been properly deeded over to the United States government by the state of Missouri, and they weren't sure the federal court system would have jurisdiction. The best way I can give this to you as an example is that when the charges were filed on him, he was filed on for the murder of Tony Bates and the rape of Linda Needham and kidnapping. Oh, and kidnapping the four kids for the purpose of rape. But then when they convened a grand jury a couple of days later and started putting all the things together they'd come up with, they realized that this couldn't work because the spot where Tony was shot, where the traffic stop originally was made, was definitely on Fort Leonard Wood, but that wasn't a fatal wound. The place where he was shot later and killed was probably not subject to federal jurisdiction. So in the end, he was never charged with the murder of Tony Bates or Linda Needham. But the United States attorney in Kansas City came up with 4 charges, 3 of which were capital cases, meaning he could get life in prison or the death penalty. And the 4th charge was the assault on Tony Bates for shooting him on post, even though he later died off post. So it gets kind of confusing there with
wow,
the jurisdictional
issues. Very convoluted,
yeah. Oh, yeah, very convoluted. And it was something that was not understood here locally. People just did not get that. But it worked out fine in the end. And mm-hmm. as I said, the backup was that the CID agents had put together the same case. They got the same information as the FBI agents at the same time, the same evidence. And so had the federal prosecution failed, the Army was in a position to put him in front of a court-martial, and for that part, it didn't matter where the crimes occurred. He was fair game.
Good. So they had backup on backup. But that's still not considered like a case of double jeopardy. If one fails to convict, can the other still convict on the same cases because they're
different
governmental agencies?
It's two different sets of jurisdiction and offenses.
Yeah.
You know, they couldn't charge the feds. The Federal Bureau of Investigation couldn't mm-hmm. present a prosecutable case for the murder of Tony Bates and Linda Needham because they were probably off base. And even if they were on base, that section of land hadn't been properly deeded over, so they had no jurisdiction. But for the Army, it didn't matter. They could nail him on both of those charges. So it was a very smart move on the part of the military and the FBI. Bill Castleberry and Perry Elder need full kudos for that one.
Well, he only got convicted on the one murder, though.
Yes, but...
I mean, I know there were other charges.
Yeah, but you have to understand that rape on a military installation like that is a capital crime. Death penalty or life in prison. The murder is the same thing. And then there's a third statute, kidnapping of the four kids for the purpose of rape is also a capital crime. And he was convicted on all three of those. Plus, he was convicted on the assault of Tony Bates and given 20 years for that one. So he drew three life sentences and 20 years.
So this guy should never theoretically see the light of day again.
He's listed as not for release. Sitting at the federal.
Go ahead,
sir. He's currently sitting in the federal penitentiary in Tucson, Arizona. A lot of people want to know that, so I'll throw that in.
Okay, so talk to me about this dual personality, this bad Johnny, good Johnny nonsense. When they go to trial, is this something that his defense is trying to play pretty hard, or do they know this is a losing battle, but he's throwing this aspect out there?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that one as to their mindset, but they are definitely throwing it out. They have videotaped him under this supposed hypnotic trance where he goes into these details. And this part gets really convoluted. And I was lucky enough to get sufficient detail in the transcripts and the interviews that if you're a court junkie who is interested in the court case, you will thoroughly enjoy the court transcripts, but it gets really intense and really involved. And they definitely tried to sell the jury that he was in this split personality situation. This was back in the time when Sybil and the Three Faces of Eve, which were other paranormal type situations that I'm sure you're familiar with, that were in the media at the time. I'm sure that's where he got the idea. But he made a couple of mistakes doing it, and as luck would have it, the second FBI agent assigned to Fort Wood, Tom Dunowden, had just come back from Quantico, where they had covered a case up around New York in a federal hospital that had similar overtones and was using hypnosis on some of the victims up there, and he was able to detect that watching these films that he's faking it, and here's why he's faking it, which he relayed to the federal prosecutor, and basically the federal prosecutor blew his insanity defense out of the water. I don't want to spoil the
right. No,
the shot,
I understand.
You know, seeing what some of the little giveaways were, but yeah, he flat gave it away in some of his actions that he was faking.
Once he's put away, I mean, this had to be a freak that she didn't die, right? The one girl just had this bullet pass through her that she's in this. Is she still alive today? Is she okay on a regular life path? What do we know about her story?
I know a lot, but I don't release it. I will tell you that she is married, has three kids, and lives a long way from the Ozarks under a totally different name. And that's
excellent.
As far as I go.
Well, that's good to know. I just wanted to know she was able to continue a normal life and as normal as can be for that situation.
It appears that she did.
That's good. It's an amazing story.
We have one
story.
Other wrinkle.
Okay, please.
Oh, we have one other wrinkle here that hasn't come up.
Okay.
In October of 1976, two other kids went missing on Fort Wood under these same circumstances.
And the
case file is simply their vehicle is parked here, they're not with it, and you now know as much as the MPs at the time. Nobody knew what happened to them or where they went. However, the second these four appeared and the base story as to what happened here came up, they started digging. By 8 o'clock the next morning, they already knew that Thornton had been the first guy to report this other vehicle abandoned at that particular location. And under the circumstances, that was as good as a confession for the officers working it. They knew he did that other crime. But we've never been able to find the bodies. He will not talk about it. It's an unsolved double homicide.
Do you think he'll ever open up about it, or is it just going to remain an unsolved mystery?
My personal feeling after everything I've researched on him and the remarks and the serial killers in particular and everything else I can come up with is he will never talk about it.
Has there ever
got
been any
wrong?
Right. I mean, has he ever cracked and spoken to fellow inmates or anybody about it that they've tried to utilize that information or no?
The closest he's come was something that I could not track down. According to one report, while he was being escorted to a federal court hearing, which didn't go very well for him, as he left the courtroom in the custody of two federal marshals, he allegedly made the remark, "Well, Castleberry's never going to find those kids now." And I've never been able to track those two marshals down to verify that that actually occurred. Mm. You know, this was in the age prior to computers, and it's amazing how much we've progressed in the law enforcement field using computers. As an example, I desperately wanted a picture of him at the time of these crimes, a booking photo. Every jail that he was in did not have a booking photo. I contacted every one of them.
Why is that?
I can't really answer that. The only thing I can get one hint was that, well, the FBI took possession of all the booking photos, and the FBI can't find them either.
Very strange. What a chilling, horrific story. Being a part of that investigation, how did that impact you going forward in law enforcement?
Well, it probably had an overly emotional impact on me because I had been a trooper for 6 years. I just started the seventh year, and I had never run into this before. I mean, I was used to dealing with bad guys who got shot and maybe killed, and that car wrecks where people were killed. That's routine. But here's four kids driving along, minding their own business, and the great white shark came out of nowhere and attacked them, and it just tore me up. I cried about this case for 40-some years. I don't mind admitting it. It gave me a case of PTSD or whatever they're calling it these days.
That's horrific. Well, thank you, sir, first of all, for serving and protecting and doing what you could to bring justice to this world, because that, you know, that's a special person that takes those jobs, and coming from a family of law enforcement, I appreciate that. And thank you for sharing the story so that the victims are not forgotten about and the story doesn't just fall by the wayside.
Well, we'd still like to find the other two kids, but we've run out of, we have no lead we can follow.
He was so messy with those four.
And that's a strange paradox, because every indication was he took his time with the first two, and literally the case file is their car was parked at the veterinary clinic on Fort Leonard Wood. The kids are not with it, and you now know everything in the case file. Nothing. And then with this one here, like I said, he got sloppy, although he did try to cover his tracks, you know, besides asking the officer who relieved him to have the scalp washed. He also called Forney Field and asked if there were going to be any helicopter flights over that area that day. You know, here's four bodies leaking red on white snow. It probably could have been spotted from the air. And this is back at a time frame when Fort Leonard Wood had a custom. Every morning, they launched a Huey, and it patrolled the border of Fort Leonard Wood, did a complete 360 around the cantonment, the entire base. And so that may have been in the back of his mind also. But he called there to check and see if they were going to be flying that day, and the answer was no, they weren't, at least not in that area. So he did a number of things to cover his tracks.
You know, did they not question why? Yeah, why would he? You know, that's strange too. Why would he call? That has to be a weird red flag to think of anyway.
No, actually it wasn't. They did that constantly, you know, finding out where they were going to be flying because they might have an operation going in that area, a special poacher watch or something. So that was not an unusual question.
Okay.
You know, it was kind of rare, but it wasn't unusual.
Right. All right. Very strange stuff. Get the book, folks. Read it for yourself. There's so much more to the story and the aftermath. Frozen Tears, the Fort Leonard Wood MP Murders, J.B. King, the author. Thank you so much, Mr. King, for coming on and sharing with us today.
Well, I thank you for the invite, and I wish you the best.
Thanks. We'll look forward to talking to you again in the future. And as you have other books come out, please don't hesitate to let us know. We'd love to visit with you again.
Okay. I'm working on another one that you might be interested in, but that's a couple of years down the road.
All right. We will be waiting for it. That's it for this part of the interview, folks. For those of you that are full subscribers, stay tuned. We've got Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals coming. For those of you that are just listening to this or our free podcast base, thanks for tuning in today and being a part of the program. You've been listening to True Crime Tuesday. We hope you enjoyed today's program of True Crime Tuesday. And remember, if you'd like the full episode with the Dumb Crime Stupid Criminals aspect, all you have to do is go over and subscribe now for Stitcher Premium. Use code word Darkness Radio, all one word, to get some deep discount savings for your 1 year subscription. And it will give you access to all of our archives from Darkness Radio. There's over 1,000 episodes up and available and more being added constantly. You get all of the episodes of True Crime Tuesday, and you get all of the other great programs that are part of Stitcher. Hundreds of thousands of hours of programming for $5 a month, commercial free. You can't beat that, so don't even try. Go subscribe now, and remember to use keyword Darkness Radio for those key savings.